Okay, we are on. Thank you again, Kelly. So, what we just did was talk about the paper, which is being turned in. And you missed that because I forgot to bring the iPod. Sorry. Now, here we go. Questions about anything else? Thoughts? Announcements I'm supposed to make? Pardon? No. I've started to schedule the review sessions. I'm looking for appropriate rooms at the times that are appropriate, and I didn't finish. So I'll get those. I'll put them on the website as soon as they come up so you can put them in your calendar. Anything else? Okay. We'll go back to Bronfenbrenner and Galinsky. Okay. And we were looking at, I was looking at some of the propositions from his article, the 1990 article that you have, Parent-Child Relationship, I think it's called. And thinking about the parenting process during the interpretive stage, since that's where we are in Galinsky, talking about the interpretive stage, and then what Bronfenbrenner had done in those propositions was point out the conditions under which the parent-child relationship is likely to be effective, and saying that it requires that we have parents who are engaged with the child, that we have an environment that supports the parenting. And proposition four in that particular article suggests that the effective functioning of child-rearing processes is, if you're going to be successful at this, if the family is going to operate to create a setting for children that works, is we're going to have patterns of exchange of information, two-way communication, mutual accommodation, and trust between the principal settings in which the children and their parents live their lives. That means work and school and childcare. And I had a wonderful example of that given to me yesterday by a childcare provider who was talking about some of the difficulties that she has in working with some parents when she's taking care of their children, and contrasting parents who don't ever seem to have time to talk when they drop off and pick up their children, and don't seem to be terribly interested in what the child is doing, and because they then don't know what's going on in the setting that the child is in, it's not likely that they're going to be supporting what is going on in the child care center, giving a child no opportunity to reinforce the concepts or practice the skills that the child has been particularly interested in the childcare setting. So the communication between home and childcare setting in those cases is minimal. And it's the parents who drive that. The childcare providers are in the setting. There they are. They're there early. They can stay. They're willing and eager to talk to people. But parents seem to be too rushed in their lives, and maybe it's because they have other responsibilities, maybe their work doesn't allow them to get off. You know, there are all kinds of possibilities for the parents' ecosystem not to support what Bronfenbrenner says the children need in order for their development to be optimized. In contrast, you have parents who come, hang out, stick around, talk to the child care providers about what they're doing, what the child is interested in, have the child show the parent at the end of the day what the child is particularly interested in, and then the parent goes off with a set of ideas about what the child is interested in and can do, and tries to acquire the same kinds of equipment or materials that will promote the child's skills in the same way, play the same kinds of games at home, and in general support the child's reinforcement and construction of the understanding that the child is developing in the childcare setting. The other side of that, it's a transaction. The other side of that is the parent who spends time with the childcare providers has the opportunity to talk to them about what the child is interested in at home so that they can pick it up. It's a two-way process. But it requires, because of the nature of the childcare setting that the parent is dropping off and picking up the child from, it requires that the parent build in the time to do that communication. So it's a parental responsibility, and of course the parents are in an ecosystem that may or may not support that. From the childcare provider's point of view, it's the childcare provider's responsibility to be available and interested. And that's one of the features of the childcare that we encourage parents to look at. Do the childcare providers have time to talk to you about what's going on? Do they take that time? Are they willing to spend an extra 10 or 15 minutes with you if you have arrived at a reasonable time? Of course, my favorite childcare provider says that she's quite willing to stay late and talk to parents. It helps if they bring a bottle of wine, red wine. But that's not a requirement. Bribery or reward will help in some cases. But that's a concrete example, very fresh from a discussion yesterday, about how you do that. What does that mean in reality? It means that the parents have to make sure that that communication is happening. There are many other manifestations of that proposition. If it's the parent's place of work, how does the parent's place of work support the parenting behavior? What do you do as an employer to support the parent-child relationship? Terry Eric, who happened to be a college classmate of mine, but grew up in Vermont and spent the rest of his life here after college running the... Anyway, down in Bennington, the Motor News, they swap the spare parts thing for classic cars. What? Hemmings Motor News. Yeah. Yes. Thank you. Terry was the president of that. And Hemmings Motor News turned out to be a very fine place to work, in part because Terry got interested in the parent-child relationships and started a movement in Vermont about 20 years ago. Started first with his employees and then tried to get it going statewide and nationally, and the point was to support parents' involvements with their children, particularly their children's schools. So he instituted a first day of school holiday for his employees, as happens in other countries. He was aware that in many areas of the world, the first day of school is a holiday, and all parents take their children to school, and they spend at least part of the day in events that are helping the parents get acquainted with the school and familiar with the teacher and knowing what the child is going to do, and give the teachers time to talk with parents and learn what they're about. So Terry Eric started that in Vermont, and for a while many companies were doing that, saying, okay, if you have a child in school, and somebody pushed him on it, yes, a grandchild, any child that you're responsible for or deeply interested in, you go to school the first day, and it's a paid holiday, the first day of school every year. That's one of the little things that people can do. Other companies encourage parents to attend events that their kids are in. They make up the time. It's called flex time. I want you to work 37 and a half or 65 hours a week, whatever it is here, but we can make that flexible as we can, so that you can participate and observe and go with your child to important events. Employers promote the parent-child relationship when they say, okay, everybody gets 3 weeks of sick time, but you don't have to be sick yourself to take it. It's called family sick leave. So if you're sick, you can take it and stay home. Please stay home. We don't want you. If your child is sick and needs to stay home, you stay home, and you can take that as paid time for sick leave. And that's a broader interpretation of sick leave than many companies do, and it's one that supports the parent taking care of the child rather than trying to figure out how they're going to get coverage for a child with a fever or who's throwing up so the parent can go to work and still, or not go to work and still get paid. Other favorite examples of helping parents do the job? So mothers who have employees who are mothers who have babies bring them to work for the first year. What do you do with them after a year?
After a year, they need to be in charge.
They need to be somewhere else. Okay. And does it work?
Wonderful.
They're totally unproductive for the whole year.
No. They're very productive. Babies are absolutely very content to be on the year then. It works.
Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful. Contributing to the couple relationship by providing childcare when the parents might be able to do something else. My wife does that as a childcare provider too. I probably shouldn't put this on, but anyway, we take the children that she takes care of at least once or twice a year. We try to shoot for the parents' anniversaries, and we just keep them for the evening. They come to dinner with us and parents go out to do their thing. And no charge. We just do it because it's kind of fun. Lets me have time with the kids, which I like. And the parents really appreciate it. It's part of supporting their relationship by reducing the challenges of being with kids. And as I've said before, couples often neglect their relationship when they have young children. Colleen, I'm really glad you mentioned that particular one, because if nobody had had an example, I was going to give this one. I went to a presentation last week by a neonatologist physician who does newborn care in South Africa, Cape Town. And he was talking about the importance of supporting mothers breastfeeding and being available for their children. As happens in traditional cultures, where in many cultures infants are never separated from their parents, they're always in contact with somebody. And good child care, particularly for very young infants, is extremely difficult to find there as it is here, and very expensive. And so what he did, because he believes in breastfeeding and a lot of contact with children, was he just made a general rule in their clinic, which is a very large clinic, everybody brings their babies if they want to. And they created a breastfeeding lounge for the babies. And somebody in the audience, when he did this presentation, said, you know, well, can you really do that? And he said, well, we do it. We've been doing it for several years. And as an employer, he said, I do it because I believe in parenting and in infants development. I think it's important. But he said, as an employer, I also have employees who are happier, more productive, miss less work, and their babies develop better because they're with their mothers. So it can be done. And then, of course, my immediate question after his presentation was, what if a father wanted to bring his infant to work? And he said, I guess. Hadn't thought about it. Let's see. It turns out he doesn't have any male employees, so it doesn't matter because all the nurses and office staff are female there. But the physicians, about a third of them are male. Okay. We need those kinds of communications, and we need to be in a situation where parents will be supported. And Proposition 5 for Bronfenbrenner takes that to the next step, which is, in order to do that, we have to have public policies and institutions that support parenting. So the effective functioning of our child rearing requires public policies and practices that provide place, time, stability, status, recognition, belief systems, customs, the whole macro system schmear that support child rearing activities. Not just by parents and caregivers and teachers and the other professionals, but also relatives, friends, and co-workers, so that the child has a community, a village, a community that supports the parenting and the children's development, so that other people, other than parents, take on responsibility for making sure that children are being appropriately and well reared. And we need to have all of our economic and social and political institutions, the legislature, government institutions, agencies, industry, the tax system, the economic system generally, responsive to the needs of kids and of the communities that are responsible for those kids. And then if that happens, then maybe during the nurturing stage and the authority stage and the interpretive stage, which is where we've been, if that happens, maybe parents will be able to do a good job and their children will be able to grow up with a valid and differentiated view of the world that they live in and the skills that they need to do well in it and to protect it and to maintain it. The interpretive stage, I want to make a few more comments about it. Because as we're looking at the interpretive stage, that issue of how do you understand the world becomes foremost. And we talked about the difficulty, complications provided by temperament. We didn't talk about gender, but one of the issues that parents have to deal with is the gender of the child that you get. It's a male or female or something, some mixture of the two, probably. Most of us are comfortably either male or female. But then the society and the family and the individual parents have interpretations of what that means. So part of what we get to do as parents is to interpret maleness and femaleness to our children in general. What does it mean to be a male? What does it mean to be a female? How do you understand the society and its expectations? But within the microsystem of the home, you actually interpret it on the ground, as they say, or where the rubber hits the road for the individual child who is male or female and whose activities will be influenced by sex, whose relationships will be influenced by sex, and whose roles will be influenced by sex. What sets families apart, what creates the diversity among us, is first, which sexes are represented in the family? Do we have male and female parents? Do we have grandparents? Do we have a family of 6 girls, a family of 6 boys, 3 of each, 2 of each, 1 of each? Okay. So the structure of the family is in part reflective of the sex of the kids. And then the attitudes and expectations and restrictions placed on each sex by the parents or by the other siblings or by grandparents or whoever else is in that setting determine how the children are going to start off with their view of themselves as male or female and other people as male or female. And families differ greatly in how important the differences are and how strictly they're enforced and which parent enforces them and who gets the most restrictive roles and activities and who gets the privileges in the family, who has the power. There's power in relationships, the expression of affect in relationships, the degree of reciprocity in relationships, all reflect the sex of the participants. And parents bring to the family their experiences growing up and their interpretations of what it means to be male or female. And then they translate those in their relationship, and then they impose them by the way they create their transactions with their children, and what they allow their children to do, and what they restrict them from doing. So some families have those very traditional, very separate roles and activities, and very gendered relationships. Male-female relationships are different in some families because men and women have very different roles, very different expression of affect, very different views in many cases of the world. And then at the other end of an imaginary spectrum, there are people who don't pay much attention to whether you're male or female. It's sort of one of those things that happens and it's not going to influence what happens in this particular family. And this particular family is going to teach you that you're human and that's what counts. And you need all the skills you can get and you need the full range of possibilities within the family. Most families in this culture still have different expectations for males and females, and they have different ways of behaving toward male and female children. And mothers and fathers treat children differently. They approach child rearing differently. And that will probably be forever so. It's a very gendered world. We are a sexually reproducing species, and we are genetically different. And those differences provide a little bit of a base for developing different ways of dealing with the world. And then on that base, parents create sometimes very strong differences. And we as children are coping with those differences and trying to make sense of them. And then getting over them sometimes when we get out in the real world and discover that what our parents have done to us wasn't necessarily the best thing they could have done for us. We learn that we have sexist parents and now we get to get over that. Or we discover that we have very egalitarian non-sexist parents and then we go into a sexist school system or a sexist work setting or we try to have relationships with people who have sexist attitudes. And the sexist in that usage means people who believe that one sex is better than the other and differentiates the privileges and the roles and relationships and activities of the two. So what you get as children, whether they're male or female, and the mix of that will affect the microsystem within the family. And just as temperament influences the way you transact with children and the way parents, by the way, also have temperaments. So you can have a difficult parent, you can have a difficult mother, you can have a difficult or easy or slow to warm up parent, and that's transacting with the child's temperament. Just as temperament helps shape that microsystem, so does sex, the gender, and your interpretation of the differences between the two sexes. And some of you have heard me say this before, but I'll say it again. Even those of us who don't want to differentiate between the sexes unnecessarily and don't want to treat our children differently because they're male or female, find ourselves, unless we're extremely unusual people, we find ourselves doing it and then having to explain it. And it's fun to look at the research on how people treat children differently depending on whether they believe it's a boy or a girl. There's some fun research on that. You just put the kid in a pink suit or a dress, give it a female name, even if it's a little boy, and people will respond differently to it. They will treat it differently. They will have different expectations for it. And it's discouraging, actually, for some of us to see how robust that finding is over and over and over again, even among those of us who think we are not sexist, that we are not differentiating the sexes. It's something that we, if we want to combat it or not recreate it within the family microsystem and in our roles as parents, we have to be very aware of what we would do differently, and then we have to constantly monitor our behavior. It helps to videotape yourself as often as possible so you can see that you do it differently. And that isn't to suggest that males and females need to do their parenting the same way. I think that's asking too much. Fathers and mothers are often built differently and have different interests, and that's probably inevitable. And they do different things with kids. They enjoy different things with kids. What you see if you videotape is that male children, male infants, and female infants respond to parents differently too. So it's a transaction that's going on that is gendered, and it's based on the child's activity level and enjoyment of large motor activities and response to big things and loud noises and the biological sensitivity of their bodies, what they can tolerate and what they like. And you see that boys and girls are different, and they create a different dance with the parents, and you end up with the parent-child relationship reflecting those differences that are very small between boy and girl babies, and not necessarily real big between the parents, but they come out in different kinds of transactions with boys and girls. And then they get elaborated. Another of the complications is reflected in the Strauss article that you have. How do you become an authority, and how do you deal with kids who are defiant? And Strauss addresses, Murray Strauss is one of the world's experts on the effects of punishment and research on forms of punishment for children. There are two or three other people that often appear in the same kinds of publications, but Strauss at the University of New Hampshire has been studying corporal punishment, spanking, paddling, twisting ears, yanking kids around by the arm, things that perhaps fall short of child abuse. He's been looking at their effectiveness and their long-term effect on children for many years, and his article presents his current position on why spanking doesn't work in the first place, so it's not an effective way to discipline a child, and it's harmful. So it's not effective unless you want to harm your child. So he suggests that we need to practice other ways of setting limits for our children and helping them learn how to behave appropriately in the setting. And he's one of the people who just simply tackles the question head on. Spanking is not the best thing to do and is more harmful than anything else you might do to discipline a child. So why don't you do something that is more effective and less harmful if you need to restrict a child's behavior or express your anger to it? Thinking Ronfenbrennerianly, what happens when you spank a child? Positive affect, right? affect gets more positive because you spank the kid. That's tongue-in-cheek. Reciprocity, you want a high degree of reciprocity? That's one of the reasons we stop spanking children as they get older, because they look for more reciprocity. What's reciprocity when you hit a kid? You get hit back. That's reciprocity. And many parents will suggest that they stop spanking their children when their children started hitting them back. Adolescents begin to do that, and spanking or slapping kids around stops when you realize that the power has equalized because of the child's growth. As the kid becomes an adolescent, the power is equalized. Reciprocity is going to increase. The kid's going to slap you around a bit, and the affect in this dyadic relationship is going to go in the tank. And it's not the kind of activity that you're going to want to continue unless you're training a Golden Gloves boxer. And then maybe you want to slap your kid around and you want to do it equally and you want to do a training with gloves on in a ring. But to do it as a form of discipline doesn't work. And what it creates for the microsystem is roles that are based on power rather than competence. Dyadic relationships that have high conflict, negative affect, and the inability to engage in a primary dyadic relationship that is going to be developmental. The idea that you can share your knowledge and engage in activities that the child will learn from when the threat of physical pain is always in the background means that the microsystem is not going to support dyadic relationships that become developmental relationships. So kids in households where spanking, corporal punishment is regularly used, learn to avoid the parent. They learn that exercising your power and creating physical pain for other people is an acceptable way to behave, so they go out in the playground and they go to school and they hit other people, which is going to get them in more trouble there. And you're not teaching them the skills that they need to be self-regulating by understanding the environment that they're in as one that they can be competent in and engage in appropriate activities and relationships in so that they can be successful in it. If the child's behavior is controlled by the threat of punishment, then somebody who is able to punish the child and willing to do that is necessary in any setting where you want the child's behavior to be controlled. And what happens with kids who are spanked regularly is that their view of the world is, if the spanker is not around, I can do whatever I please. I just need not to get caught. So when kids who are routinely spanked go out into the world to meet the rest of us, their attitude often is, I can do whatever I want, particularly in a setting where it's already been defined as not a spanking setting. So you have kids who come to school and defy authority and defy teachers and refuse to be involved and engaged because they know that they can't get spanked there. And if they don't like the setting, then you just behave in a way that will get you thrown out, and you get thrown out. And then you don't have to learn, you don't have to do the work, you don't have to engage with people that you don't understand. So you can get thrown out. But you can behave any way you want because they're not going to hit you. So if you think about the view of the world that the child who's being spanked at home routinely develops, it's not one that is going to help in the mesosystem. And parents have a responsibility to help their kids learn to deal with other settings and to be prepared for those settings. And it's much more effective if you teach the child what is expected and encourage the child to behave appropriately and engage in a relationship that will support the appropriate behavior in joint activities and positive affect and reciprocity. increasing power for the child rather than increasing fear for the child. There's a little bit about parenting styles in several of the readings. I haven't given you anything that specifically goes into the parenting styles, but if you look for the approaches to parenting that Strauss and Honig and others describe, you'll see that the parents have different approaches, and those approaches create a pattern of relationships and roles and activities within the setting. So if you have parents who are authoritarian and rely on power and the threat of punishment to raise children, they're doing different things as parents. They're creating a different microsystem than parents who are being authoritative. And they, in turn, are doing it differently and creating a different household, different microsystem, than parents who are being permissive. So when we talk about parenting styles, we're talking about the relationships and the expectations and the routines that parents are creating with their children in the microsystem. So it's not just a parenting style, it's a microsystem style that gets developed. Honig, in the article that you have, Raising Competent, Confident Children, is lots of fun. What Honig tried to do was sort of capture 50 years of parent education and child rearing research and put it in one place. In the context that we have a macro system that creates challenges for parents, and two or three of the articles that you have suggest that the current world creates challenges for parents. The communication among settings is not as good as it might be. Parents are rushed. Kids are sometimes overscheduled. Expectations for parents at work, with two parents working, not having adequate childcare. It's a world that creates challenges. It's an ecosystem that creates challenges for parents in doing a good job. And Honigan, a couple of the other authors, but particularly Honig, have suggested that here are some rules, some principles, some suggestions, some strategies to keep in mind as you think about how you're going to be raising children. So as you look at that particular article, you'll see that she has a whole bunch of suggestions, and you can actually go through that article and look at each of those suggestions and translate it into Brontë-Brennerian terms. Is this a suggestion about the nature of the dyadic relationship you have with the child? Is this a suggestion about the microsystem pattern? Is this a suggestion about mesosystem connections and links? Is this a suggestion about exosystem? No. And if you do that translation, you'll see that she has covered the whole ecosystem, and that most of her suggestions, there are a couple of exceptions, but most of them can be translated into Brontë-Brennerian hypotheses. They're consistent with the notion of creating developmental dyads, a variety of activities, complex activities, joint activities with kids, developmental trajectories. It's all in there in Honig's article. I'm not going to go through that specifically because I think you have enough of the Brontë-Brenner, especially now that you've wrestled with creating your own set of rules. You can look at hers and see how hers stack up against a developmentological view. Going back to the interpretive stage for a minute, a couple of other things that I wanted to connect to before we look at the interdependent stage. Yeah. In the interpretive stage, Galinsky talks about the parental responsibility and activity that are involved in interpreting the world to the child, interpreting themselves to the child, interpreting the child to the child. And There's a piece of research that isn't mentioned in anything that you have, but it's familiar to some of you, and I just wanted to draw a conclusion from that. Some of you have studied it in psychology classes or in women's studies courses, and a few of you in human development courses have or will. And that's research by Belenke, who is retired from the psychology faculty here, published in a book called Women's Ways of Knowing. And I particularly recommend it if you're male, because it'll help you understand women. If you're female, because it'll help you understand yourself. And if you're an educator, because it'll help you understand knowledge. And if you're a researcher, because it's an interesting piece of research. Belenke and her colleagues interviewed a couple of hundred women of different ages and social classes and situations, extensive interviews, which were focused on the women's experience as learners and knowers of things. So it's a study of cognitive development and people's approach to developing new knowledge, their attitudes toward knowledge in general and where it comes from, and then their own experiences both as children and later in learning how to learn and developing a view of themselves as learners. Some of them were college students, some of them were all kinds of people, all different social classes. And it's an interesting book because they sort of categorize the women that they interviewed into six different groups, each reflecting a different way of knowing, an attitude toward knowledge. I'm not going to go through those. Some of you are familiar with it. It's an interesting way to look at something that most of us don't think very much about. Think about it for yourself. Where did you learn to learn? And what's your attitude toward yourself as a learner? Are you somebody that expects to be given the knowledge, or do you expect to go out and get it? Where does knowledge come from? Well, books, but where do the books come from, or television? Are you a contributor of knowledge? Do you construct knowledge? Those sorts of questions. Who's responsible for whether or not knowledge is useful or correct? The thing I want to point out is that in looking at the lives of their couple of hundred subjects, Belenke and her colleagues found that most of them ended up talking about what happened in conversations with their parents. There's an interesting chapter in the book called The Politics of Family Talk. And in it, they describe the family conversations, what happens around dinner table, what happens in conversations about politics, religion, school, what do parents say to children about the children as learners and contributors to knowledge. How do the parents respond when the child asks a question? And what they found were very interesting and specific microsystem patterns and ways of relating and roles within the family for parents and children that were directly connected to the way the adults in the study approached learning. And they found that in some families, children are not respected as learners, and their inability to learn is often pointed out by the parents. The kids who are called stupid, kids who are asked the question, "Don't you know anything?" by parents who don't teach anything, who then give the child the notion that they are incapable of learning, incapable of understanding, and incapable of constructing knowledge themselves. And these kids go off to school from that kind of situation and are sometimes surprised that they actually can learn. but more often approach school in the way that their parents have approached them. They consider themselves, by the time they get to school, they consider themselves stupid. They consider themselves not very capable of learning, so they don't put out much effort. And it may be only years and years later, decades later, that through some other experiences, they discover that their parents were wrong, that they actually can learn. Is it possible? Is it possible for parents to tell you that you're so bright that you already know everything and nobody can teach you anything? I don't know.
Like, I don't know.
Why am I here? I already know everything.
Yeah.
I don't know. It would be an interesting study to do. It's an interesting question. I don't know. It didn't happen in my family, so you know, I knew I had a long way to go by the time I got to school. There are certainly, the comment is that there are kids whose parents praise them so much that it becomes meaningless after a while. And the kids do have an attitude that they don't have to work to understand anything. What the parents in that situation, I'm trying to figure out where they would fall in Belenke's classification. I'm not going to come to a decision about that quickly enough to make a suggestion about that. What we do see is kids who cover, what I see is kids who cover their lack of skills at learning. They don't know how to do it. So they cover it by pretending they know everything. And don't get engaged, particularly in school settings, they don't get engaged because they're afraid of failing. And they're often kids who've been punished for not knowing something. But there's a lot of bravado in it. There's a lot of, I'm gonna genderize it and call it macho crap that says, you know, I'm supposed to know everything. That's part of the macho code for us. You're expected to know everything. Even though people aren't going to teach you to learn it, you're expected to know. So you can't ever admit that you don't know something. And we get into school situations where we don't know things, and we've been taught to cover that up. So we bluff, we make things up, I invent knowledge. That's what I tell my wife regularly. I just made that up. And it sounded good, didn't it? But that's a male thing. You know, you got to make up this knowledge about the world in order to be better than everybody else and competent. And we see kids who do that who aren't doing well in school and won't acknowledge it. They can't ask somebody to help them. They can't say, I don't understand that. Could you repeat that again? And that's one of those sex differences that we see in families, in some families, that boys are expected to know things and to discover things on their own in some subject areas. And girls are given much more help in learning the skills. I don't want to get into that sex differences stuff at this point. But in the issue of kids who have a very poor, unreasonable, and unrealistic view of their skills are often covering the lack of skill. And they're claiming to be able to do things. And it sometimes feels like the more exaggerated they are, the more exaggerated their claims are, the more difficulty they're having in learning things. The kid who is really, really smart, genuinely smart, and does learn things very quickly, rarely depends on anybody else to tell her that. You know that. You know, it's fine if other people recognize it, but I watch kids who are really, really bright and really fast learners, and they're so curious, and they go out and just sponge up information. They don't have time to worry about whether somebody else understands that they're smart. They enjoy it if somebody says, "Oh, you're so smart." Then they go back to learning and understanding the world. They also typically develop very good skills at acquiring information and see themselves eventually as being able to contribute to knowledge. But kids who have more difficulty absorbing things and learning things and understanding things are more likely to be dependent on somebody to help them, to give them answers, and see themselves as not too competent at this. Back to the microsystem issue, what you're seeing as the kid is developing is how the parent views him or herself as a learner, how you approach learning generally, and if you have that kid who comes to school and pretends to know everything, you have a pretty good guess about what happens at home. Parent pretends to know everything. If you see a kid who has no curiosity, you probably can guess at home that curiosity has never been reinforced. And an example given to me this morning of a kid who doesn't say very much in class, is a high school student, and she doesn't talk very often, but recently she was observed in a situation where there were a couple of teachers and an aide, and a conversation was going on, and she said something, which is very unusual. She said something to this group, and it was something that was very thoughtful, and to the observer it was very provocative. You know, wow, something deep is going on here. There, you could have, had you responded to it, you could have had a very interesting discussion with the kid and learned something about her that nobody knows. That people just don't know her because she doesn't contribute. But the observer got an opportunity to see why she doesn't talk very much in class. The response from the adult in the situation was, "That's cool," and changed the subject and went on. Girl just tucked back into her shell. She's not there. But the observer thought it was fascinating. It was the first time in a year that she had heard this girl say anything that could have, should have led to a conversation by the adults who are supposedly responsible for her learning. But it looked like they've just given up. So they weren't even aware that she'd said something that could have been the subject of a very interesting discussion. So the observer was frustrated by that and discouraged by it. You know, if you're trying to get kids to be curious and participate and contribute, you probably need to listen to them. I'm listening to myself. I just heard what I said, so it's okay. I'll listen. Okay, let me move on briefly to start talking about the interdependent stage. And this is Galinsky's term for what happens when puberty hits and the adolescence begins, and you begin to move into a bigger world. What's going to happen? Puberty forces changes in all of your relationships and the expectations in the family. We know that. The intellectual changes that bring us closer to being adults also cause changes in all of those relationships as we change the transactions we're having with other people. So puberty and the beginning of adolescence are generally fairly disruptive of the microsystem pattern. And there's some interesting research on that developmentally. If you look at the amount of conflict that goes on in the family, it increases dramatically as each child goes through puberty. Pubescent kids are annoying. Pubescent kids are a mess, and they create conflict. And you can watch that happen if you video families just in conversation. Pubescent kids are more likely to disagree with their parents, they're more likely to disagree with their siblings, they're more likely to challenge, they're more likely to be negative in their affect. They're just a mess. Nobody likes pubescent kids, including themselves. Their peers don't like them, their teachers don't like them, and it doesn't matter whether you're early or late maturing, nobody likes you. So it's just, you get through it and it's okay. But it changes the microsystem, it changes the dyadic relationships within the family. And it's fascinating from a family systems perspective to watch that. It's very predictable. You can have a family where there's almost no conflict, and it'll increase. There still won't be a lot, but it'll increase as the kid goes through puberty. What you see is new potentials and skills that are changing those transactions. There's a lot more negotiation by the child toward more equal power and greater reciprocity, and a challenged affect. So adolescents begin really seriously trying to become adults and change their position in the microsystem. They're changing their roles. They're engaging in different activities. They change their relationships with their siblings. So they have much less tolerance for younger sisters sometimes, for little or younger siblings for a while. And then it improves again as they take on a more parental role. The roles change as you become an adolescent. How you demonstrate affect changes. Adolescents are more emotionally expressive. And if they get upset because of the changes that are taking place in the adrenal system, because of those changes, when they get upset, they get more upset and they stay upset longer. So their behavior is often driven by stress hormones, and they remain upset longer than children do. It's just a biological fact. So how you deal with your physiological arousal when you're upset becomes an important issue. And we teach kids to deal with being upset, and sometimes we don't teach them very well. And then we have to reteach them in adolescence because they are expressing their affect, their negative affect, much more strenuously and much more effectively. But you also have to change how you demonstrate your positive affect. You know, you like something a 10-year-old kid does, you pick him up, you give him a hug, you know, you smooch him all over and rub his hair, and you know, he's just happy as a clam. If this can't be a real surprise, but if it's been that way in your family, that's okay. You know, the kids are like, oh, mom, you know, dad. But you can do it. Do that with a pubescent kid, and you are blowing the kid's mind, and the kid is going to tell you, get your hands off me, don't get close to me, don't touch my body, it's developing in ways that I don't understand and I'm really self-conscious about, so watch how you hug me, and there won't be any picking me up and giving me a big smooch, particularly by dad if I'm a girl, or by mom if I'm a boy, because A, you can't pick me up anymore, and B, I'm not going to tolerate it because I don't want to be that close to your body for the next year. Okay. So how you demonstrate your affect and your affection has to change, and that puts everybody kind of on eggshells for a little bit. It's fascinating to watch people negotiate. Okay. No, close the bathroom door. You know. Okay. Lock the bathroom door. I'm not going to talk about your body for the next 2 years because you're going to tell me you don't want me to do that, and you're going to get embarrassed, and you're going to go to your room, and you're going to be self-conscious, and our relationship is bleh because you are so self-conscious about this body that's changing. And the whole family has to shift. And some parents deal with that inappropriately. Some people decide that, oh, we've got a new button we can push, so let's tease. So we'll do that. And then the negativity goes, and the reciprocity of conflict goes up. And the kid decides that he's not going to be civil to you for the next 20 years because you are being disrespectful of her need for space and privacy. You have new authority relationship. The kid is now out of the household more than the kid is in. As kids go into adolescence, they spend more time away from home, more time in settings where they are supervised by other adults, and more time in settings where they are not supervised by adults at all. They're with their peers. And if you just plot where the child has been over the course of a week and how much of that time there were adults in charge, you see that the number of times where there's been no adult around has increased. The time away from adult supervision increases with adolescence. What does that mean for parents? Terror. What do you do with that? The kid's in new dyads with people you don't know anything about. They're engaging in new molar activities that you do know too much about and wish they weren't engaged in. And you're afraid they're engaged in them, and now you have to deal with that. And that's probably just about the perfect point to stop, and we'll go on from there on Monday.